previously on Popping Collars.
In the book, I do not believe he's Episcopalian. They made him Episcopalian then for the show, which is interesting.
Right.
Jerks. HBO. Come on.
HBO. Just throw a priest on there as a consult. That's all you gotta do.
I'll help you. I'll help you out.
There are lots of priests out there who would love that job.
That's right. I'll come be your cast chaplain. The crew.
Yeah. HBO.
I love craft services. Come find me.
More quick note, and then I will say, welcome to Popping Collars, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey, that first voice you heard with the big old hey is Michelle Meach, second time back with us at Popping Collars.
Always glad to be here, Greg.
Coming to us from Ypsilanti, Michigan. Welcome, Michelle.
Thanks.
How are things up there? Cold, I imagine.
It's freezing. It's 11 degrees, and this is the first freezing time of our winter right now, so taking Bella outside is not a fun prospect.
Oh, gosh. I don't think about dogs in the cold weather. That's probably pretty rough.
If I could provide toilet facilities inside for her, I would, because she's miserable out there. She's miserable.
They can be trained like cats, right, to go to the toilet.
Let's not go there, no.
Joining us again, my brother, Kyle Goodman, Statesville, North Carolina. Welcome, Kyle.
Glad to be here.
And for the first time, with us at Popping Collars, Kathy Masick, all the way from La Grande, Oregon, coming to us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, good to be here.
And my name is Greg Knight. I am your host for this conversation that leads us down the path of the intersection between religion and pop culture, and these guys are here to help me do that. So thank you for being here. Back in the mid-90s, this is what I remember. A movie came out that was really a Luke Perry vehicle, as I recall. And also, it was one of the first post-Pee-wee performances by Paul Rubens, because I remember that being a big deal when Buffy the Vampire Slayer came out. And the movie, of course, flopped. It didn't do so hot.
Yeah, the movies, I've never seen the movie, actually.
Don't
so.
Oh, really?
Really?
I don't.
It's,
yeah,
nothing,
it's not
nothing like the TV show.
Yeah, Joss Whedon got kicked off the project apparently partway through
of the movie.
Yeah.
He got taken out of his hands.
The movie's been
fairly early on.
We have it because Thorman likes complete collections. You know? So we have the movie, but it's still in its wrapper. So
it's completed. I love it.
Oh, wow.
I hate it, but I have to have it. But it stuck around in people's consciousnesses long enough for the creator, Joss Whedon, to kind of pitch the project again, this time to an up-and-coming network, the WB. And it became really a cult phenomenon. This is a show that ran for eight seasons?
Seven.
Eight in comic book form, which I think there are 10, actually, in the comic book.
Heston has those, too.
Yeah. They're great. I've read the comic. Yeah, so seven seasons of a show that's really kind of an exploration of what it means to be a teenager struggling to survive in the madness that is sort of high school and adolescent. Let me kind of throw this out there. What's one of the early Buffy episodes that you kind of remember? Because I think that Joss Whedon made a point early on of using his Monsters of the Weeks to be metaphors for kind of a teenage condition, a teenage something. And there's always some experience that I think speaks to us personally. So what's an early Buffy that kind of stands out for you?
I've got a place to start, Greg.
Okay, go for it.
I was going to mention the very first scene of the very first episode. And I think in some ways that very first scene is, it's sort of a metaphor for what the whole show was about. I remember it well, and I don't necessarily remember all the scenes and all the episodes well. But it opens up in the high school after dark, and a guy and a girl are making their way through the halls. They're about to get up to what, you know, teenagers get up to in a high school in the middle of the night. And the whole time, of course, you're thinking that the guy is the vampire. And so the suspense is building because this guy is going to take a bite out of this girl. And right before the credits roll, you know, the vampire face comes out. And instead of being the guy, it's the girl. Mm-hmm. And it sort of flipped the trope completely on its head. And I think that's partly what the whole show was about. You know, that show started and came on at a time when there really weren't a whole lot of female heroines on TV, you know, leading ladies. Most of the women's roles, at that time were sort of supporting roles for the male lead. And here was a show coming on that was really in part about empowering women and, you know, kind of pushing against that gender gap. And that very first scene sort of flipped it on its head, and for the rest of the show, we have a strong female lead who is carrying the show and doesn't need to have another strong male, you know, to fight her battles for her.
Yeah, I know the scene you're talking about. That's where Darla is introduced right away.
Right.
Mm-hmm. She's the vampire, and that's exactly I rewatched the whole thing recently, and that scene stuck out to me for the exact same reason. It felt to me when I watched that scene again, it felt to me like, right, finally, there's an instance where the woman or the girl is not beholden to Prince Charming coming to save her. I mean, just in that scene, even though it was about the vampire, it was clear that this was going to be set up differently from anything else you've seen. And they played it up, and they did that throughout the series, where they would play up these tension moments where you thought something was going to happen, and then it turned out that something else happened. They did that a lot throughout the series, where you weren't quite sure if someone was evil or good, and then they would flip it on its head. But then the main characters, the season regulars, they were written so complexly that there was both light and dark inside of each one of them. And that's something that I appreciated deeply, is that they opened that conversation up so that it wasn't that Buffy was always smart and figuring things out. Sometimes she was an idiot and made the wrong decisions. And then you've got vampires with souls as well. So it really put that on its head as well, not just the male-female dichotomy, but the good and evil binary too was flipped. And that happened pretty early on, because Angel was introduced pretty early. I can't remember if he was in the first episode or if he was in the, he was in the first five, one of the first five where he was introduced. But I don't think we found out he was a vampire until maybe episode 7 or 8. I don't know. But that was introduced pretty early on.
I think it's interesting what you were talking about the different, you know, dynamics and the characters, and you're talking about Buffy in particular, and that, you know, light and dark dynamic, or that duality of living, you know, as a vampire slayer by night and prototypical high school, you know, teenage girl by day. And in some ways, she was sort of like the female Peter Parker. You know, she always got everything right when it came to slaying the vampires. But, you know, even though she was, you know, the pretty girl, I guess, it was she never really fit in the high school. She never really found her niche other than her little gang who helped her, you know, kill vampires. You know, it wasn't right. The Scoobies. It really wasn't until she graduated from high school that she even felt like she was validated as being, you know, a part of that community. And of course, by that time, you know, it's really for her work saving the high school again and again and again that that she finds appreciation.
There was one early episode that, you know, and granted, I haven't seen a few, but there was one early episode that I really loved that was, and this speaks to the whole Joss Whedon using basically the high school setting and monsters as kind of a metaphor for weird things that happen in high school life. And one of them was the kind of Freaky Friday gone bad episode where the mom was a witch, I think, and she wanted to kind of relive her childhood, and she like took over her daughter's body.
Amy, the cheerleader.
And I just always thought that was such a great kind of analogy for the folks that couldn't let go of their past, right? Mm-hmm. And they just that was like their glory days. And this was a mom who was willing to do anything, even sacrifice her own daughter's, you know, life to relive those moments again, even if they're not hers. And I just thought that was a great kind of way of showing that episode in a really kind of creepy way.
It was very creepy, and it was episode three, so that was pretty early on.
Yeah, memorized.
Yeah, the witches seem to be pretty intense, and once you start getting into the whole Willow storyline and start going down that witch trail, you start to realize like the witches are no nonsense on this show. Like they really have a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's one of those Whedon ways of kind of reversing the script, right? You know, it's like Kyle was saying with that very first episode. The scene is supposed to end with the girl being chased by the guy. And it's flipped, and it's the girl that's in the position of power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Buffy as the Slayer, and Faith as the Slayer after Buffy dies and Faith comes into the picture. It's always the people that you least expect, the people that society tells us to least expect to be the people in power, that are the people that seem to have the most power. And that's something that I appreciate about Whedon stuff in general, but especially about Buffy. It does have a lot to tell us about how power is used and who has it and who can sort of lay claim to it and who tries to control it.
It's an interesting, you're right, because even at the end of season six, when Willow tries to destroy the world, it's Xander, the one who has no supernatural or magical powers at all, who...
The bumbler, yeah.
Yeah, he's the bumbler of the whole series, but he's the beloved character, too. He's the beloved sidekick kind of guy. And
it's because he's so transparent. He's just right there.
Yeah, and he's the one that stops Willow from stopping the world. He's the one, and it's because he says, "I love you."
So let's talk about Angel a little bit. So there's one great moment, I guess it's second season, right, where Angel becomes the big bad. And it all comes out of this moment where he and Buffy have sex with each other. He experiences this moment of great joy and gets his soul perfect happiness. Right, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. And gets his soul back or loses his soul. So he's able to retain his soul as long as he's morose and
brooding.
As long as he's
an all Edward Cullen.
Yeah, that would be another reason I don't like Angel very much.
Yeah.
As soon as he becomes an interesting character, he loses it. But, you know, and again, back to that whole high school trope of sort of being metaphors. What I love about that scenario is that it very much is the, you know, will you still love me tomorrow scenario, right? This, like the anxiety that everyone has, mm-hmm. especially women, I would argue, of, you know, once this happens, how are things going to be different between us, like in our relationship? Stuff going forward. And having been one of those people that will sometimes change because something got a little too heavy or something got a little too close or a little too intimate and you start to push those things away, it's easy to identify that. And yet it's happening on kind of a larger kind of supernatural scale here. But it's that simple story of rejection and betrayal
mm-hmm.
that that you really internalize, I think, as a teenager, to the point that tomorrow doesn't seem quite possible anymore.
That piece in particular is really interesting because the aftermath of that is that Buffy, she actually sees the school counselor, right? Mm. And everyone says, oh, let me guess what's going on. You got a little too close to your boyfriend and he changed. And, and yeah. She's like, well, yeah, that's an understatement, but yeah, that's essentially it. And so it is this, I think you're right about that, that it is this fear, but it's also this reality that happens when we get too close to people and we push them away and we don't trust that the intimacy can be maintained. Or that we're safe in that intimacy, or that we're safe being that vulnerable with one another. And it has an effect on Buffy throughout the rest of the series, I think, because her next boyfriend is a total, he's just human, and he pulls that trick on her where he gets her to sleep with him, and he blows her off. That's in college, right?
No,
he blows
Adam
her off completely.
Yeah. No, not Adam.
No, the guy before.
Yeah.
The good-looking... What? Yeah. Parker, right. Yeah, I think his actor name is Adam.
She gets with Riley, and she keeps him at a distance until mm-hmm. he leaves and says, you're mm-hmm. not letting me in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then she doesn't. Then she gets with Spike. And so it's this series of keeping things that's the complexity of her character is that she, and it builds throughout the series, is that she is so strong that she doesn't believe anyone can be with her in her strength. Mm. And she's got to keep people at a distance.
And because of her special calling, you know, whoever she's around is in danger too. So she has, I think, been sort of thought all along that she can never have a normal life. So why should she try? But she keeps trying anyway.
So going back to the very first season, and it's a recurring theme, how many times does she die? Twice? Three times?
Twice. She dies briefly.
She dies at the homecoming thing there.
Right.
And then Kevin comes. Yeah, and then she dies. Right. And then she dies for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this idea of sacrifice comes up quite a bit, mm-hmm. I would say, on the show.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's interesting because, and Kyle was a part of this conversation, we had a conversation about Doctor Who a few episodes back for Popping Collars, and, you know, we were weaving in, like, you know, there are all these kinds of spiritual and religious tropes that show up, and Chris Arnold made the point of saying, I would imagine the show's creators would interpret these things in a very different way. And I would imagine Joss Whedon would interpret these things in a very different way.
Yeah.
And yet, this idea of sacrifice, redemption, and resurrection are central to the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that they have something really powerful to say. And again, it's not the hero that you expect to be doing this. It's the person that you kind of least expect, right? This girl
mm-hmm.
sacrificing her life for everyone, for the redemption of the world, right?
Yeah, and she's not the first. She's the latest in a long line of young women who have done this.
Which makes the piece at the very end, and here comes the big spoiler, the very last episode when she finally gets it, that the trick to conquering the first, which is the big evil, like mm-hmm. the biggest evil, the first evil that there ever was, the reason why the Slayer line came into existence, the trick to conquering that first is not to keep the power or to even take more power for herself.
Just to share it.
To disseminate her power.
Right.
And give it to all
right.
potential Slayers.
Yeah, like who says it just has to be one? That's what, you know, the hierarchy has said.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What if we can change that? And that made all the difference.
The whole series ends with Pentecost, then.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely. It's a Pentecost kind of day down there in the Hellmouth.
And I think that's probably the at the very end there, the very end of the last episode, when, you know, the city has disappeared into this pit, that's the first time she really smiles. She relaxes and she smiles.
Yeah, that theme, I'll tell you, that really hit it for me that of all the pieces in that, I went, oh my God, that's, if that's not Christ, what is Christ? I mean, that, talk about, yeah, about a metaphor for us as Christians, mm-hmm, to watch her give her power away like that, to have no fear that giving power away is not going to make her less strong. It's going to make her stronger because,
right,
everyone around her is stronger.
Right.
And the way they portray it, you know, there's this little girl with a bat.
With the bat, yeah, I remember that too. Yeah,
she's a bat.
Yeah.
And then there's another woman who stands up and blocks her male partner from hitting her again.
Yeah.
So the way they portray that strength,
yeah,
that slayer strength, is really, really powerful.
Yeah.
Women, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And not to get us too far afield of Buffy, but it's still Whedonverse, so I'm okay with it. is Mal during the Alamo scene, right, of Serenity? Mm-hmm. And you know, by this point, Malcolm's world has been turned upside down as River has been kind of exposed to be this kind of otherworldly creature who's capable of much more than he thought when he first brought her on his ship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his crew is willing to sacrifice themselves as Reavers are kind of tearing down. And he's on this mission where, you know, all he's trying to do is just get information to everyone. And that's worth everything, mm-hmm, in his life at this point. That's kind of similar to what's happening here at the end of Buffy. It's this idea of, you know, if we just let people tap into the power, if we just share it, we're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to see the truth, which is what Mal is trying to show, right? Where he's trying to show everyone the truth.
Yeah.
And we're going to see the truth if we can share it with each other. Mm-hmm. The resurrection is interesting because it she's actually resurrected from one network to another network. Resurrected from the WB to the UPN. The moment at the end of the, I guess it's the first episode after the resurrection, right? Or maybe it's a couple episodes.
I think it's a couple in.
When she shares with Spike.
Yeah.
What ultimately was going on. And she tells her friends one thing and she tells Spike the truth.
Yeah.
And I that moment has always really stuck with me as a really powerful moment on the show. And I think it has something to do with how Buffy sees herself as a protector to the point that she can't even sort of be fully honest with the people that she loves the most because it would break their heart. And obviously her heart is broken into 1,000 pieces in this moment because she's kind of lost. She's lost paradise, which was a really powerful moment. I wonder how you guys kind of interpreted that when you saw it.
Yeah, I think her friends, well, first of all, they acted on their assumptions, which were wrong. And they assumed she was in hell. And so they wanted to get her out, of course. And their need for her was so strong that they didn't even think of any other possibility. And I think she understood that and protected them, like you said. She wanted to keep protecting them from realizing what they did, which was pretty awful, really. And so she knew that it was okay to do that with Spike.
You know, Kazantzakis, The Last Temptation of Christ, movie and book. Although I haven't seen, I've never seen the movie. I've
really?
Only ever read the novel. Yeah.
Read the only book, ever read the novel. Didn't like it, so, yeah.
Well, he's got this one moment in the book that I always loved, which was the resurrection of Lazarus, or the calling of Lazarus from the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this, you know, he was really playing off of the narrative that's coming from the gospel, which is Jesus at just lost in grief, just absolutely lost in a moment of grief, and at, you know, in this kind of desperate moment, he calls Lazarus back, and Lazarus isn't the Lazarus that everyone remembers. He's something else. He's kind of lost something,
yeah,
from having passed away. And it's kind of this moment where the Jesus in The Last Temptation kind of takes a step back and says, kind of, what have I done? Like, what am I capable of? And what is this? I've kind of, you know, I longed for my friend, and what came back wasn't really my friend. It was something else.
What an interesting connection, thinking about the vampires and, you know, having been, resurrected in a sense, but not with the soul. You know, they're this soulless creature inhabiting a body, perhaps with the same memories, the same thoughts, but, you know, they don't have that essential thing that really made them them, other than Angel, who is cursed with the soul, and he's cursed with the soul because, you know, it's a punishment to have done all the awful things he's done over hundreds of years, and then, you know, having to live with the guilt and remorse that came when his soul was given back. But, you know, it occurs to me that all of us walk around perhaps having that thing, but, you know, how undead are we all walking around this life? I worry more and more that the people we encounter in our community are living in this kind of undead, soulless, you know, life. And that's not about being a monster necessarily, but it is about, you know, just not having that spark, that joy, that meaning. You know, I encounter that story in my community more and more and more. You know, just, you know, what's the purpose? What's the meaning other than just to, you know, go to work and be a part of the grind and, you know, work really hard and find a small return? What part does the soul play in that? You know, what part, you know, does the deeper meaning that we have in faith play in that? And I find that to be a struggle for people.
That's how her storyline spins out after she's resurrected. Is she struggles with that. She struggles with, why am I here? I mean, once she gets past the fact that she's been ripped out of heaven, and it may be after the musical number where she tells, that's where she tells everybody.
Yeah.
So maybe after that, but she struggles with, why am I back? What is this about? Why was I brought back? And then, because the whole, the speech at the end of season 5 she gives to Dawn is, the hardest thing in this world is to live in it. And then Dawn has to remind her of that once she's back.
And so then I would say that Spike becomes kind of a natural kind of attraction for her to go to at that point. Because, you know, think of someone who's trying to, who feels soulless, who feels like they're trying to figure things out. You're kind of drawn to the charisma, I would say, of this creature who's kind of figured out how to do it, how to live kind of the soulless life.
Yeah.
And yet is on his own path of redemption to becoming something new.
I actually wrote a sermon about that. I used Buffy and Spike's relationship as the basis for as a metaphor for transformation, and how people that are on the other side of transformation, because something has happened to Spike by that point. He hasn't gotten his soul back, but something has shifted, and he keeps witnessing to that fact, and it has to do with the chip and his love for Buffy that he's developed, that something has shifted in him, which is why he goes to seek his soul. So there's some kind of transformation that he's gone through by that point. And that Buffy obviously has gone through because she's been resurrected, that on the other side of that, it's like the only people I can talk to are the people that have been through this hell with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that have been through this kind of this experience, because the rest of the world just feels like this plasticine surface, that there's no depth to it. And on the other side of that transformation are the people that you intuitively know get it on some level.
Earlier in the conversation, Greg was talking about intimacy and people in our churches kind of, you know, when they come up against that, you know, they kind of run. And I wonder if that's something that might be missing from, you know, our experience of the gospel story as it's being told in the church. You know, are we kind of hitting over and over again, you know, a shallow telling of the richest story ever told? You know, I think that's an interesting question for me. You know,
it's the foot washing. For me, it always comes back to the foot washing, right? Because that's the minute that Jesus is explicit. Like, do this.
He doesn't
pull any punches. Right. Do you get it? Do you understand what I'm telling you? Do this. This is what you do for each other. And yet, that's the one thing that we will never do for each other.
Like, there's so many churches, Greg. You know, I was so used to foot washing out in California. When I got here, I can't find that many that will actually do it. People don't touch each other's feet here. It's too intimate. It's too...
Can't do it.
I did it once on a Monday, Thursday service in my community. And I've been here long enough to have done everything else twice, but we have not gotten back to foot washing because I invited everyone to do it, and I think I had two takers, and I was one of the two.
I have trouble getting people to come up for an anointing.
But, I mean, you know, these are, touch.
It's too close.
And I think, that's so, you can see it. And I think, you know, for churches, it's different. Like for Buffy, you know, it's pushing away because you don't want to get too close to people because of what, you know, you are in the greater scheme of Sunnydale, right? But for the folks in our churches, I think that it's, you don't want to get too close because maybe you don't know what that's ultimately going to mean, what that path is ultimately going to lead you down in your life. And, you know, the soulless thing, you know, yeah, it is, it's a grind, and yeah, it's day in and day out, but at least you know what to expect.
Right.
Like, if you start going down this road of shifting your life, like Michelle was talking about before, you don't know where that call is going to take you and where that path is going to take you. And it can take you into really powerful places and into people's lives that you would have never expected. And that's a scary proposition, I think, for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think part of it, too, you know, I think there's a couple of levels. One is that we're scared of each other. But I think we're also, just like Buffy, we're scared of ourselves. We're scared of not being enough. We're scared of our own strength sometimes and our own weakness. I mean, the Marianne Williamson quote that is overwrought, but still it applies, is that we don't want to let our own light shine. And, you know, we're walking into Epiphany tomorrow, into the season of Epiphany, the season of the light shining. And that's the one thing I think that we really don't get about ourselves is the power of our own light, the power that we can bring to one another, and we're scared of it.
When Joss Whedon wrote you back, you almost had a heart attack. You still talk about it to this day. It's a memory that lingers on, like meeting Spike at Dragon Con, or seeing Nathan Fillion in L.A. What will your children think of Angel when they're grown? When they're grown, oh, will they love River like you did when they're grown?
A lot of separation. So now we can do our Go in Pieces segment, where we talk about our ministries, our parishes, what it is that we're doing, and highlights and stuff like that. And we can let people know how to get in touch with us. So, Kathy, how can people find you in LeGrand? Where are you in LeGrand? What are you doing?
We're at the corner of 4th Street and O Avenue in LeGrand, Oregon. And we're also on Facebook. We used to have a website, but it was very unsatisfactory, and the website masters were totally unsatisfactory. So we've taken it down, and we hope to find some knight to rescue us and do our website the way we want to. Yeah, but there we are. We're on Facebook. We're a tiny parish. Average Sunday attendance, maybe 25 or 29.
What's the name of the parish?
St. Peter's.
St. Peter's.
Yes, and great group of people.
Kyle, what are you doing, and how can people find you? Well, on Twitter.
I'm not on Twitter. I'm still not on Twitter. I'm getting there. It's a New Year's resolution to get a Twitter handle. But in the meantime, you can find me on Facebook, and you can find me at the church's website, www.concordpreschurch.com. The church also has a Facebook page you can find. And I am the pastor at Concord Presbyterian Church in Statesville, a wonderful congregation of about 200 folks. You know, we worship at 11 on Sundays, and would love to see you if you're ever in the Statesville, North Carolina area.
Awesome. Michelle, what are you doing in Michigan? And how can people find you for 5 minutes at a time?
Yeah. I'm in the southeastern part of Michigan. I work for the bishop's office. I'm the ministry developer, which means that my territory is all over southeast Michigan, Lansing, Detroit, Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, Pontiac, Jackson, all of it. And most often I'm working with one of my five congregations, the total ministry congregations here in the diocese. But I can always be contacted through the diocesan office. A lot of my sermons I post on my WordPress page, which is Folded and Unfolding. And the Buffy sermon is on there, by the way, the Buffy site. Nice. I think I called it Love and Transformation Buffy Style. Oh, and Facebook. Yeah, I'm always on Facebook being obnoxious. So.
My name's Greg Knight. I'm at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida. Anyway, you can find us online at bbts.org. Popping Collars is all over the place. Exciting news with Popping Collars, actually, is that recently we were ranked number 6 on the top movers list for Stitcher, which is those are the podcasts that are moving up in the ranks the fastest. So we actually leapfrogged 14,000 other shows. We are currently ranked in the top 2,000 on Stitcher, so that's very exciting. We are featured on Episcopal Cafe, which is a wonderful website that I recommend folks check out. And this episode will be on there as soon as possible. We're also, again, we're on Stitcher. We're on TuneIn. Oh, you can find us on Twitter, at Popping Collars. You can find us on Facebook. You can actually friend us on Facebook instead of liking us. Liking us, that's way too corporate. We appreciate friends. So you can friend us. Just go to just search Popping Collars and you'll find us. And you can also email us, poppingcollarspodcast@gmail.com. We're always taking emails. So for everyone here, Kathy, Kyle, Michelle, and everyone involved with Popping Collars, thanks for listening and keep those collars popped. We'll see you next time. What?